"Strong man?" she asked, when they had left the cave where her daughter was sleeping far behind. "What did you think of the magpie that flew to Gecko?"
"That was no magpie," he said. "It had a woman's voice. But I didn't say anything. The others would only have said I was crazy again."
Chapter 48. Waiting. The castle in the lake was an oyster that had closed itself off from the world. Not a single window had a view of the mountains around. Not a single window looked out on the lake, lapping at its dark walls. Once you had left the gate behind you, there was only the castle, its dark and narrow courtyards, covered bridges linking its towers, walls painted with worlds, like nothing that existed in the world outside these windowless fortifications. They showed gardens and gently rolling hills populated by unicorns, dragons, and peacocks, and above them an eternally blue sky with white clouds drifting over it. The pictures were everywhere, in the rooms, along the corridors, on the courtyard walls. You saw them through every window, and there were many windows inside the castle. Painted views of a world that didn't exist. But the moist breath of the lake made paint flake off the stones, so that it seemed in many places as if someone had tried to wipe the painted lies off the walls. Only from the towers, where the view was not interrupted by walls, aureoles, and roofs, could you see the world that really surrounded the castle, the great lake and the mountains that lay around it. Mo was immediately drawn to the battlements, where he could feel the sky above him and look at the world that fascinated him so much that he kept making his way deeper and deeper into it, even though it might not be any more real than the pictures on the walls. But Violante just wanted to see the rooms, with windows looking out on painted worlds. Rooms where her mother had played in the past. She moved through the castle as if she had come home, tenderly caressing the furniture, which was grey with dust, scrutinizing every piece of earthenware that she found under the cobwebs, and examining the pictures on the walls as closely as if they told her tales of her mother.
"This was the room where she and her sisters did their lessons. Look, those were their desks. They had a horrible tutor. This was where my grandmother slept. This was where they kept the hounds. This was the dovecot for the pigeons who carried their messages."
The longer Mo followed her, the more it seemed to him that this painted world was exactly what Violante's near-sighted eyes wanted to see. Perhaps she felt safer in a world resembling the scenes in Balbulus's books. Invented, easily controlled, timeless and unchanging, every corner of it familiar. Would Maggie have liked to see painted unicorns from her window, he wondered? Eternally green hills, clouds that were always the same? No, he answered himself. Maggie would have climbed up to the towers, like him.
"Did your mother ever tell you if she was really happy here?"
Mo couldn't keep the doubt out of his voice, and Violante heard it. The girlish softness that changed her face so much disappeared at once, and the Adderhead's daughter was back.
"Of course, very happy, until my father made my grandfather give him her hand in marriage and took her away to the Castle of Night."
She looked at him defiantly, as if her mere gaze could force him to believe her and to love this castle. There was one room that didn't let you forget the outside world. Mo first found it when he was exploring on his own, searching for some place where he wouldn't feel that he was a prisoner again, if in a beautifully painted dungeon this time. Daylight dazzled him as he suddenly stepped into a hall in the west wing of the castle. It had so many windows that they turned the walls into lace. Light, reflected from the water of the lake, danced on the ceiling, and the mountains seemed to line up outside as if they wanted nothing more than to be seen through all those windows. The beauty of the view took Mo's breath away, although it was a dark beauty, and his eyes instinctively went to the somber mountain slopes in search of any trace of human beings. He filled his lungs with the cold air carried in on the wind, and did not see that he was not alone until he turned and looked south to where Ombra lay somewhere beyond the mountains. Dustfinger was sitting in one of the windows, the wind in his hair, his face turned toward the cold sun. "The strolling players call it the Hall of a Thousand Windows," he said without turning. And Mo wondered how long he had been sitting there. "They say that Violante's mother and sisters had poor eyesight because their father would never let them look into the distance for fear of what awaited them there. Daylight began to hurt their eyes. They couldn't even make out the pictures on the walls of their rooms clearly anymore. And a physician, who came here with a couple of the motley folk, told Violante's grandfather that his daughters would go blind unless he let them see the real world now and then. So, the Prince of Salt, that was what people called him, because he'd made a fortune in the salt trade, had these windows made in the walls and ordered his daughters to look out of them for an hour every day. But while they did so, a minstrel had to tell them about the terrors of the outside world, the heartlessness and cruelty of human beings, disease running rife, and hungry wolves, so that they'd never want to go out into it and leave their father."
"What a strange story," said Mo.
As he went over to Dustfinger's side, he could feel the fire dancer's longing for Roxanne as strongly as if it were his own.
"It's only a story now," said Dustfinger, "but it all really happened here in this place."
He blew a gentle breath into the cool air, and beside them three girls were formed out of fire. They stood close together, staring into the distance, where the mountains were as blue as yearning. "It's said they tried to run away with the strolling players several times. Their father tolerated the motley folk only because they brought him news from other princely courts. But neither the girls nor the strolling players ever got any farther than the first trees. Their father had them caught and brought his daughters back to the castle. As for the strolling players, he had them tied up there." Dustfinger pointed to a rock on the banks of the lake. "And the girls had to stand at the window." The figures did exactly what Dustfinger described. "Freezing cold and trembling with fear, until giants came and dragged the strolling players away." Mo couldn't take his eyes off the fiery girls. The flames depicted their fear and loneliness as expressively as Balbulus could have done with his brush. No, Violante's mother had not been happy in this castle, whatever her daughters said.
"What's he doing?"
Suddenly Violante was standing behind them. Brianna and Tullia were with her. Dustfinger snapped his fingers, and the flames lost their human form and twined around the window like a fiery plant.
"Don't worry. There'll just be a little soot left on the stones. And for the moment," he added, glancing at Brianna, who was staring into the flames as if enchanted, "it looks beautiful, don't you think?"
It did. The fire surrounded the window with red leaves and flowers of gold. Tullio instinctively took a step toward it, but Violante roughly pulled him back to her side.
"Put it out, fire dancer," she ordered Dustfinger. "This minute."
Shrugging his shoulders, Dustfinger obeyed. A whisper, and the fire went out. Violante's anger did not impress him, and that alarmed the Adderhead's daughter. Mo could see it in her eyes.
"It did look beautiful, don't you agree?" he asked,
passing his finger over the sooty sill. It was as if he could still see the three girls standing at the window.
"Fire is never beautiful," said Violante with scorn. "Have you ever seen anyone die by fire? They burn for a long time."
She obviously knew what she was talking about. How old had she been when she first saw someone die at the stake? How old when she first saw a hanging? How much darkness could children bear before darkness became a part of them forever?
"Come with me, Blue Jay." Violante turned abruptly. "There's something I want to show you. Only you. Brianna, get some water and wash off that soot."
Brianna hurried away without a word, but not without casting a quick glance at her father, who held Mo back as he was about to follow her ugliness.
"Beware of her," he whispered. "Prince's daughters have a weakness for mountebanks and robbers."
"Blue Jay?"
Fiolante's voice was sharp with impatience.
"Where are you?"
Dustfinger painted a fiery heart on the floor. Violante was waiting on the staircase in the tower, as if afraid of the windows. Perhaps she liked shadows, because she still felt the mark on her cheek from which her cruel nickname came. Meggie had been called very different pet names when she was little, my pretty, sweetheart, honey. Meggie had grown up in the certainty that the mere sight of her filled Mo with love. Presumably Violante's mother had shown her daughter that kind of love, but everyone else had looked at her and shuddered, or felt pity at the most. Where had Violante hidden as a child from all those glances of dislike and all that pain? Had she taught her heart to despise everyone who could show the world a pretty face? Poor Ada's daughter, thought Mo, as he saw her standing on the dark staircase, so lonely in her dark heart. No, Dustfinger was wrong. Violante loved nothing and no one, not even herself. She hurried down the steps as if running away from her own shadow. She always walked fast and impatiently, picking up her long skirts, as if cursing the clothes women had to wear in this world at every step she took.
Come with me. I want to show you something. My mother always told me the library of this castle was in the north wing, with the unicorn pictures. I don't know when it was moved or why, but see for yourself. The tower guard room, the scribe's room, the women's room, she whispered as she walked, the bridge to the north tower, the bridge to the south tower, the aviary courtyard, the hound's courtyard.
She really did move around the castle as if she had lived in it for years. How often had she studied the books describing this place? Mo could hear the lake as she led him through a courtyard containing empty cages. Gigantic cages made of metalwork, as elaborate as if the bars were meant to be substitute trees for the birds inside. He heard water breaking on the stones, but the walls surrounding this courtyard were painted with beech and oak trees, with flocks of birds sitting in their branches, sparrows, larks, wild doves, nightingales and falcons, crossbills and robin redbreasts, woodpeckers and hummingbirds dipping their beaks into red flowers. A blue jay sat beside a swallow.
My mother and her sisters loved birds, so my grandfather didn't just have them painted on the walls. He had live birds brought here from the most distant lands and filled these cages with them. He had the cages covered in winter, but my mother crept in under the covers. Sometimes she would sit for hours in one of the cages until the nursemaids found her and plucked the birds' feathers from her hair.
She hurried on. A covered passage under a gateway, another courtyard. Kennels, hunting scenes on the walls, and above it all the sound of the water of the lake, so far away and yet so close. Of course Violante's mother loved birds, thought Mo. She wished she had wings, too. No doubt she and her sisters dreamed of flying away when they climbed into the cages and waited for their fine dresses to be covered with feathers. It saddened him to think of the three lonely girls, but all the same, he would have loved to show Meggie the cages, and the painted birds, the unicorns and dragons, the Hall of a Thousand Windows, even the impregnable bridge that seemed to be hovering over the lake when you looked down on it from above. You'll tell Meggie about all this one day, he said to himself, as if just imagining it could make the words true. Another staircase. Another covered bridge, like a tunnel suspended between the towers. The door at which Violante stopped was stained black, like all the doors in the castle. The wood had swelled, and she had to brace her shoulder against it to open it.
"It's terrible," she said, and she was right.
Mo couldn't make out much in the long room. Two narrow windows let in only a little light and air, but even if he hadn't been able to see anything, he would have smelled it. The books were stacked like firewood by the damp walls, and the cold air smelled so strongly of mould that he put his hand over his mouth and nose.
"Look at them."
Violante picked up the nearest book and held it out to him, tears in her eyes.
"They're all like that."
Mo took the book from her hand and tried to open it, but the pages had stuck together in a single, blackened, musty-smelling lump. Mould covered the cut edges of the pages like foam. The covers were eaten away. What he was holding wasn't a book anymore. It was the corpse of a book, and for a moment Moe felt nausea as he thought that he had condemned the book he had bound for the Adderhead to the same fate. Did it look as bad as this one by now? Hardly, or it would have killed the Adderhead long ago, and the white women wouldn't be reaching out their hands to Meggie.
I've looked at so many of them. Hardly any of them are in a better state. How can it have happened?
Moe put the ruined book back with the others.
Well, wherever the library originally was, I'm afraid there's no safe place for books in this castle. Even if your grandfather tried to forget the lake outside, it's still there. The air is so damp that the books started rotting, and since no one knew how to save them, I suppose they were put in this room, in the hope that they'd dry out more quickly here than in the library. A bad mistake. They must have been worth a fortune.
Violante pressed her lips together and passed her hand over the crumbling covers, as if stroking a dead pet's coat for the last time.
My mother described them to me even more vividly than the rest of this castle. Luckily, she took some to the Castle of Night with her, and then I took most of those to Umbra. As soon as I arrived, I asked my father-in-law to send for the other books, too. After all, this castle had been empty for years. But who listens to an 8-year-old girl? Forget the books and the castle where they stand. That's what he said whenever I asked him. I'm not sending my men to a place like the castle in the lake, not for the finest books in the world. Haven't you heard of the fish your grandfather bred in the lake and the eternal mists? Not to mention the giants. As if giants hadn't disappeared from these mountains years ago. He was such a fool, a greedy, gluttonous fool.
Anger took the sadness from her voice. Mo looked around. The idea of the treasures that had once been hidden between all these wrecked covers nauseated him more than the stench of mold.
You can't do anything for the books now, can you?
He shook his head.
No, there's no remedy for mold. Although you say that the Adderhead has found one. I don't suppose you know what it is.
Oh, yes, but you won't like it.
Violante picked up one of the spoiled books. This one would still open, but the pages fell apart in her fingers.
He's had the white book dipped in fairy blood. They say that if that hadn't worked, he'd have tried human blood.
Moe felt as if he could see the blank pages he had cut in the Castle of Night soaking up the blood.
That's appalling, he said.
It obviously amused Violante that such a ridiculous piece of cruelty could shake him.
Apparently, my father mixed the fairy blood with the blood of fire elves so that it would dry more quickly, she went on, unmoved. Their blood is very hot. Did you know that? Hot as liquid fire.
Indeed.
Moe's voice was hoarse with disgust.
I hope you aren't planning to try the same remedy with these books. Believe me, it wouldn't help them now.
If you say so.
Was he just imagining the disappointment in her voice? He turned around. He didn't want to see the dead books any more, nor did he want to think of those pages drenched in blood. As he came through the doorway, Dustfinger moved away from the painted wall of the corridor. It was almost as if he was stepping out of a book again.
"We have a visitor, Silvertongue," he said, "although not the one we were expecting."
"Silvertongue?"
Violante appeared in the open doorway.
"Why do you call him that?"
"Oh, it's a long story."
Dustfinger gave her a smile which she did not return.
"I assure you the name fits him at least as well as the one you give him, and he's had it very much longer."
"Has he?"
Violante looked at Dustfinger with barely concealed dislike.
"Is that what they call him among the dead, too?"
Dustfinger turned and ran his finger over the gold mocker sitting among the painted branches of a rosebush.
"No, no one goes by any name among the dead. We're all alike there, mountebanks and princes. You'll find that out yourself some day."
Violante's face froze, and once again it looked like her father's.
"My husband once came back from the dead, too, but he didn't tell me mountebanks were so highly honored there."
"Did he tell you anything about it at all?"
Dustfinger replied, looking so directly at Violante that she turned pale.
I could tell you a long tale about your husband. I could tell you I've seen him twice among the dead. But I think you should greet your visitor now. He's not in a very good way.
Who is this visitor?
Dustfinger plucked a fiery paintbrush out of the air.
Balbulus?
Violante looked at him in disbelief.
Yes, said Dustfinger, and the piper has left the mark of your father's anger on him.
Chapter 49 Masters New and Old.
How his behind hurt, as if he'd never be able to sit on it again. Damn all this riding about the place. It was one thing to go through the streets of Ombra on horseback, his head held high, attracting envious glances. But it was no fun following the Adderhead's coach for hours in the dark, along rough paths where you were liable to break your neck the whole time.
For Orpheus's new master travelled only by night. As soon as dawn came, he had his black tent pitched to hide there from the light of day, and only when the sun set did he heave his rotting body back into the coach, standing ready for him. It was drawn by two horses as black as the velvet that lined the coach. Orpheus had cast a surreptitious glance inside it the first time they stopped to rest. The adder's crest was embroidered on the cushions in silver thread, and they looked much softer than the saddle he'd been sitting in for days. He wouldn't have minded a coach like that himself, but he had to ride behind it with Jacopo, Violante's horrible brat, who kept demanding something to eat or drink, and showed such dog-like devotion to the piper that he wore a tin nose over his own. It still surprised Orpheus that the piper wasn't travelling with them. Well, of course, he'd let the blue jay escape. Presumably the Adderhead had sent him back to the Castle of Night to punish him. But why, for heaven's sake, didn't his master have more than 4 dozen men-at-arms to escort them? Orpheus had counted them twice, but that was all. Did the Adderhead think this handful of men was enough against Violante's child soldiers, or did he still trust his daughter? If so, then the Silver Prince was either considerably more stupid than he was reputed to be, or the rot had attacked his brain, which might well mean that Mortimer would be playing the hero again, and he, Orpheus, had backed the wrong side. A terrible idea. So he was very careful not to think of it too often. They made such painfully slow progress in the heavy coach that Os could keep up with the horses on foot. Cerberus had been left behind in Ombra. The Adderhead, too, thought keeping dogs was a privilege of the nobility. It really was high time the rules of this world were rewritten.
Slow as snails, grumbled one of the men-at-arms behind him.
Those fellows stank to high heaven, as if competing with their master's odour.
You wait and see. By the time we reach that damn castle, the blue jay will have flown again.
Idiots in armour. They still hadn't realised that the blue jay had ridden to Ombra Castle with a plan in mind, and that plan had not yet been put into practice. Ah, they were stopping at last. What a relief to his poor bones. The sky was still as black as pitch, but Thumbling had probably spotted a fairy dancing at the approach of dawn, in spite of the cold. Thumbling. The Adderhead's new bodyguard could teach anyone the meaning of fear. He was as thin as if death had taken him once already, and the scaly snake from his master's crest was tattooed across his larynx, so that when he spoke, it writhed on his skin as if it were alive. A very unsettling sight. But luckily, Thumbling didn't talk much. He did not owe his name to his stature. Indeed, Thumbling was rather taller than Orpheus, not that it was likely anyone in this world knew the fairy tale of the same name and its tiny central character. No, this Thumbling apparently got his name from the cruel things he could do with his thumbs. Orpheus hadn't found anything about him in Fenolio's book, so presumably he was one of those characters who, if Fenolio himself was to be believed, had been hatched out by the story itself, like midge larvae in a marshy pond. Thumbling dressed like a peasant, but his sword was better than the piper's, and it was said that, like Silvernose, He had no sense of smell, which was why the two of them could be near the adderhead without being overcome by nausea, unlike everyone else. Lucky for them, thought Orpheus as he slid off his horse, groaning with relief. Rub it down, he ordered Os testily, and then pitch my tent and jump to it. Orpheus thought his bodyguard extremely foolish, since he had set eyes on Thumbling. Orpheus's tent was not particularly large. He could hardly stand up in it, and it was so cramped that he almost knocked it down when he turned around. But he hadn't been able to read himself a better one in a hurry, even though he had searched all his books for a rather grander version. His books, well, they were his now, anyway. Formerly the property of the Library of Umbra Castle. But no one had stopped Orpheus when he'd helped himself to them. Books. How excited he had been, standing in the Laughing Prince's library. He had been so sure that he'd find at least one book there containing words by Fenolio, and he had, indeed, come upon a book of blue jay songs on the very first lectern. His fingers had been shaking as he freed the book from its chain. The locks were easily picked. He knew how to do these things. Got you now, Mortimer, he had thought. I'll knead you into shape like dough. You won't know who and where you are once I get my tongue around your robber's name. He had been all the more painfully disappointed when he read the first words. Oh, those leaden sounds, those badly rhymed lines. Fenolio couldn't have written any of the songs in that book. Where were the old man's songs? Violante took them with her, you fool, he told himself. Why didn't you think of that before? The disappointment still hurt. But who said only Fenolio's words could come alive in this world? Weren't all books ultimately related? After all, the same letters filled them, just arranged in a different order, which meant that, in a certain way, every book was contained in every other. However that might be, what Orpheus had read so far during those endless hours in the saddle was not, unfortunately, very promising. It seemed that there wasn't a single storyteller in this world who understood his art, or at least not in the Laughing Prince's library. What a pitiful collection of beautifully handwritten tedium. What wooden babbling. And the characters, not even his voice would bring them to life. Originally, Orpheus had intended to impress the Adderhead with a sample of his skill the next time they stopped to rest. But he still hadn't found anything that tasted better on his tongue than dry paper. Damn it all. Of course, the Adderhead's tent was already pitched. Thumbling always sent a few servants on ahead, so that his master could stumble out of the coach and straight into it. It was a fabric palace, the dark lengths of cloth embroidered with silver snakes shimmering in the moonlight, as if thousands of slugs had been crawling over the material. Suppose he summons you now, Orpheus said to himself. Didn't you promise him entertainment? He still heard the milksop's malicious words only too clearly. My brother-in-law doesn't like to have his expectations disappointed. Orpheus shivered. He sat down under a tree, feeling wretched, lit a candle, and fished another book out of the saddlebags, while Os went on struggling with the tent. Children's stories, oh, for heaven's sake! Damn it, damn it, damn it! Or not. Wait a minute. This sounded familiar. Orpheus's heartbeat quickened. Yes, these were Fenolio's words, no doubt about it. That's my book! Small Finger snatched the book from Orpheus's hands. There stood Jacopo, lips pouting, brows drawn together above his eyes, probably an imitation of his grandfather. He wasn't wearing the tin nose. Maybe it had become rather a nuisance after a while. With difficulty, Orpheus resisted the temptation to tug the book out of those slender hands. Not a clever move. Be nice to the little devil, Orpheus. Jacopo! He gave him a broad and slightly deferential smile, the kind a prince's son would like, even if the prince in question was dead. This is your book? Then I'm sure you know who wrote it, don't you? Jacopo stared darkly at him. Tortoise face! Tortoise Face. What a fabulous name for Fenolio. Do you like his stories? Jacopo shrugged.
I like the songs about the blue jay better, but my mother won't let me have them.
That's not very nice of her, is it? Orpheus stared at the book that Jacopo was clutching so possessively to his chest. He felt his hands sweating with desire for it. Fenolio's words. Suppose the words in that book worked as well as the words in Inkheart itself. How would it be, Jacopo? Oh, how happily he could have wrung his stupid princely neck. How would it be if I told you a few robber stories, and you lent me that book in return?
Can you tell stories? I thought you sold unicorns and dwarves.
I can do that, too. And I'll have you impaled on a unicorn's horn if you don't give me that book this minute, thought Orpheus, hiding his savage reflections behind an even broader smile.
What do you want the book for? It's for children, only for children.
Horrible little know-it-all. I want to look at the pictures. Jacopo opened the book and leafed through the parchment pages.
They're boring. Just animals and fairies and brownies. I can't stand brownies. They stink, and they look like Tullio.
He looked at Orpheus.
What will you give me if I lend it to you? Do you have any silver?
Silver. It ran in the family, although Jacopo resembled his dead father far more than his grandfather. Of course. Orpheus put his hand into the bag at his belt. Just you wait, princeling, he thought. If this book can do what I suspect it can, I'll think up a few nasty surprises for you. Jacopo put out his hand, and Orpheus dropped a coin bearing his grandfather's head into it. The little hand stayed open, demanding more.
I want three.
Orpheus snarled with annoyance, and Jacopo clutched the book a little more firmly. Greedy little bastard. Orpheus dropped two more coins into the child's hand, and Jacopo was quick to close his fingers over them.
That's for one day.
One day? Os trudged toward them. His toes were sticking out of his boots. He was always needing new boots for his elephantine feet. Too bad. Let him go barefoot for a while.
Your tent is ready, my lord.
Jacopo stuffed the coins into the bag at his own belt and held out the book to Orpheus with a gracious expression. 3 silver coins, 3 days, said Orpheus, taking the book. And now get out before I change my mind. Jacopo ducked, but the next moment he remembered whose grandson he was.
That's no way to talk to me, Four Eyes,
he cried shrilly, stomping on Orpheus's foot so hard that he screamed. The soldiers, who were sitting under the trees, freezing in the cold, laughed, and Jacopo stalked away like a shrunken copy of the Adderhead. Orpheus felt the blood shoot to his face.
What kind of bodyguard are you? He snapped at Os.
Can't you even protect me from a 6-year-old? With that, he limped toward his tent. Os had lit an oil lamp and spread a bearskin on the cold forest floor, but Orpheus missed his own house the moment he stepped inside.
All because of Mortimer and his stupid robber games, he grumbled, as he sat down on the bearskin in a bad temper. I'll send him to hell, and Dustfinger with him. From all I hear, those two seem to be inseparable these days, and if there isn't any hell in this world, well, I'll write one especially for them. Even Dustfinger won't like that kind of fire. Right. He avidly opened the book he had bargained for with that avaricious little devil. Bears, brownies, fairies. The child was right, these were children's stories. It wouldn't be easy to read something out of them to tempt the Adderhead, who was sure to summon him soon, for who else was going to help him pass the sleepless night? More brownies. The old man seemed to have a soft spot for them. A very sentimental story about a glass woman in love. Another featuring a nymph madly in love with a prince. For heaven's sake, even Jacopo could hardly be expected to take much interest in that. Was a robber at least mentioned somewhere? Or, if not that, a blue jay calling?
Yes, that would do it. He could step into the Adderhead's tent
and, with just a few words, read the enemy he'd been hunting so long into his presence. But instead he found woodpeckers, nightingales, even a talking sparrow. No blue jay. Curse it, curse it, curse it. He hoped his 3 silver coins had been a good investment. Nose nipper. That at least sounded like a creature he could use to get back at the boy. But wait a moment. There, where the forest was at its darkest, Orpheus's lips formed the words soundlessly, and where not even the brownies ventured out to search for mushrooms.
This camp is a very uncomfortable place to stay, master.
Ironstone was suddenly there beside him, looking gloomy.
How long do you think we'll be travelling?
The glass man was getting greyer every day. Perhaps he missed quarrelling with that treacherous brother of his. Or maybe it was because he kept catching woodlice and maggots and eating them with obvious relish.
Don't disturb me, Orpheus snapped at him. Can't you see I'm reading? And what's that leg clinging to your jacket?
Haven't I told you not to eat insects? Do you want me to chase you away into the forest to join the wild glass men?
No, no, I really don't. I won't let another word pass my lips, your grace, and no insects either.
Ironstone bowed 3 times. How Orpheus loved his servility.
Just one more question. Is that the book that was stolen from you?
No, unfortunately. Only its little brother, replied Orpheus without looking up.
And now for heaven's sake, shut up!
And where not even the brownies ventured out to search for mushrooms, he read on, lived the blackest of all shadows, the worst of all nameless terrors. Nightmare, it was now called. But once it had borne a human name, for nightmares are human souls so evil that the white women cannot wash the wickedness from their hearts and send them back again. Orpheus raised his head. Well, well, what a dark story, he murmured. What was the old man thinking of? Had that ghastly imp annoyed him so much that he set out to sing him a very special lullaby? This sounds rather as if Jacopo's grandfather might like it too. Yes. Once again, he bent over the pages on which Balbulus had painted a shadow with black fingers reaching through the letters on the page. Oh, yes, fabulous, he whispered. Ironstone, bring me pen and paper, and quick, or I'll feed you to one of the horses. The glass man obeyed eagerly, and Orpheus set to work. Half a sentence stolen here, a few words there, a snippet plucked from the next page to link them. Fenolio's words, written with a rather lighter touch than in Inkheart. You almost thought you could hear the old man chuckling, but the music was the same. So why shouldn't the words from this story act like those from the other book, the one so shamefully stolen from him? Yes, yes, that sounds just like the old man's work, whispered Orpheus as the paper soaked up the ink. But it needs a little more colour. He was leafing through the illuminated pages, looking for the right words, when the glass man suddenly gave a shrill scream and scurried into hiding behind his hand. There was a magpie in the opening of the tent. Alarmed, Ironstone clutched Orpheus's sleeve. He was brave only when dealing with smaller specimens of his own kind. And Orpheus's hope that this might be just an ordinary magpie was dashed as soon as the bird opened her beak.
Get out!
She spat at the glass man, and Ironstone scurried outside on his thin, spidery legs, although the Adderhead's men threw acorns and fairy nuts at him. Mortola. Of course, Orpheus had known she'd turn up again sooner or later, but why couldn't it have been later? A magpie, he thought as she hopped toward him. If I could turn myself into an animal or a bird, I'd make sure to choose something more impressive. How bedraggled she looked. Presumably a marten had been after her, or a fox. A pity it hadn't eaten her.
What are you doing here? She snapped. Did I say anything about offering your services to the Adderhead?
She sounded completely crazy, apart from the fact that her harsh voice lost all its terrors when it came out of a yellow beak. Your story's finished, Mortola, thought Orpheus, over, whereas mine is only just beginning.
Why are you sitting staring at me like that? Did he believe what you told him about his daughter and the blue jay? Well, come on, out with it.
She pecked angrily at a beetle that had wandered into the tent, crunching it up so noisily that Orpheus felt sick.
Oh, yes, yes, he said, irritated. Of course he believed me. I was very convincing. Good.
The magpie fluttered up onto the books that Orpheus had stolen from the library and peered down on what he had been writing.
What's all this? Has the adderhead ordered a unicorn from you too?
No, no, that's nothing. Just a story I'm supposed to be writing for his pest of a grandson. Orpheus placed his hand over the words, as if by chance.
What about the white book?
Mortola preened her ruffled feathers.
Have you found out where the adderhead is hiding it? He must have it with him.
Death and the devil, of course not. Do you think the adderhead carries it about with him publicly? This time Orpheus didn't even try to keep the contempt out of his voice, and Mortola pecked his hand so hard that he screeched.
I don't like your tone, Moonface. He must have it somewhere, so look for it, seeing as you're here. I can't take care of everything.
When did you ever take care of anything? Oh, why don't I wring her skinny neck, he said to himself, wiping the blood from the back of his hand. The way my father used to kill chickens and pigeons.
Is that any way to speak to me?
The magpie pecked at his hand again, but this time Orpheus snatched it away in time.
Do you think I've just been perching on a branch doing nothing? I've rid the world of the Black Prince and made sure that his men will help me in future, not the Blue Jay.
Really? The Prince is dead? Orpheus took a great deal of trouble to sound unimpressed. That would hurt Fenolio. The old man was ridiculously proud of his character. What about the children he stole? Where are they?
In a cave northeast of Umbra. The moss women call it the Giant's Chamber. There are still a few robbers with them, and some women. It's a stupid hiding place, but since the Adderhead thought it was a good idea to send his brother-in-law to look for them, the children are probably safe there for a good while yet. Folks say even a rabbit can outwit that man.
Interesting. And wasn't that a piece of news that could convince the Adderhead of his own usefulness? What about the Blue Jay's wife and daughter? Are they there too?
Certainly.
Mortola hissed, as if something was stuck in her throat.
I was going to poison the little witch as well, and send her after the prince, but her mother chased me away. She knows too much about me. Far too much.
This was getting better and better. But Mortola could read his thoughts on his face.
Don't look so stupidly pleased with yourself. You're not to tell the Adderhead a word about any of this. They're both mine. I'm not leaving them to the Silver Prince this time, just for him to let them go again, understand?
Of course, my lips are sealed. Orpheus immediately assumed his most innocent expression. What about the others, the robbers who are going to help you?
They're following you. They'll lie in ambush for the adder tomorrow night. They think it's their own idea, but I planted it in their silly heads. Where can the book fall into their hands more easily than in the middle of the forest? Snappers staged hundreds of such attacks in the past, and he won't have to deal with the piper. The stupid adder has left his best watchdog behind, I suppose to punish him for letting the blue jay escape. But he's only cutting into his own rotting flesh, and perhaps the magpie will redeem her own son from death with his corpse as early as tomorrow. It's a pity that if I do, I won't see the white women take the bookbinder away, but that can't be helped. Take him away they will, and this time they won't let him go again. Who knows, perhaps death will be so pleased to have both the Adderhead and the Blue Jay that the white book will be forgotten. Then I can write my son's name in it and never fear for him again.
She was talking feverishly, faster and faster with every sentence, cackling as if she would choke on the words if she didn't get them out fast enough.
Hide in the bushes when they attack, she added. I don't want Snapper killing you too by mistake. I may need you yet if the fool happens to fail.
She really does still trust you, Orpheus, he thought. He could have almost laughed out loud. What had happened to Mortola's mind? Did she think of nothing but worms and beetles now? A poor prospect for her, thought Orpheus, and a very good one for me. Good. Excellent, he said, while his brain thought swiftly of the best way to use all this information. Only one thing was perfectly clear. If the White Book fell into Mortola's hands, he himself would have lost the game. Death would take the Adderhead. Mortola would write her son's name in the White Book, and he himself wouldn't even get back the book that Dustfinger had stolen from him, to say nothing of immortal life. He would be left with nothing but the stories Fenolio had written for a spoiled child. No, there was no alternative. He must go on backing the Adderhead.
Why are you standing there gaping like a moon calf?
Mortola's voice sounded more like a bird's hoarse cry with every word.
My lord!
Os put his head into the tent, looking alarmed.
The Adderhead wants to see you. They say he's in a terrible temper.
I'm coming. Orpheus almost trod on the magpie's tail feathers as he stumbled out of the tent. She hopped aside with an angry cackle.
Horrible creature, grunted Os, kicking out at her. You ought to shoo it away, my lord. My mother says magpies are thieves, reborn.
I don't like it either, whispered Orpheus. I tell you what, why not wring its neck while I'm gone? Os's mouth twisted in an unpleasant smile. He liked such tasks. Perhaps he wasn't such a bad bodyguard after all. No, he wasn't. Orpheus passed his hand once more over his hair. Old man's hair, they called it here. No one else in Ombra was such a pale blonde. And made for the Adderhead's tent. He wouldn't be able to read the Blue Jay here for him, and whatever was hidden in Jacopo's book must wait until his audience with the Silver Prince was over. But thanks to Mortola, he had something else to offer now. The Adderhead's tent was as black beneath the trees as if night had left a piece of itself behind there. And suppose it had. Night was always kinder to you than day, Orpheus, he told himself as Thumbling pushed back the dark cloth of the tent flap, his face expressionless. Didn't darkness and silence make it so much easier to dream the world to your own taste? Yes, perhaps he ought to make it always night in this world. Once he had Inkheart back again. Your Highness. Orpheus bowed low as the Adderhead's face emerged from the darkness like a distorted moon. I bring news I've just learned from listening to the wind. I think you'll like it. Chapter 50. Lazy Old Man. Here she came again. Eleanor Loredan. The name sounded almost as if he'd thought her up himself. Cursing, Fenolio pulled the blanket over his face. Wasn't it bad enough that she was a know-it-all, a blue stocking, and stubborn as a mule? Did she have to be an early riser, too? He supposed day was just beginning to dawn outside. That doesn't look particularly inspired. Her eyes had gone straight to the blank sheet of paper lying beside him. How horribly bright and cheerful she sounded. Don't they say the muse's kisses are sweetest early in the morning? I think I read that somewhere. As if she knew anything about kissing. And hadn't he earned his sleep when there wasn't a decent drop of wine to be had in this wretched cave? Hadn't he just saved the Black Prince's life? Very well, the prince's legs were still rather weak, and he wasn't eating much, as Minerva kept saying with concern. But then all those children had to be fed, not an easy task at this time of year, and the little ones were hungry the whole time, when they weren't asking him or Darius for a story, for Reed for some tricks with fire, or Meggie for a few songs about the Blue Jay. She sang them better than Batista by now. Perhaps that's something I ought to do, thought Fenolio, ostentatiously turning his back on Signora Loredan. Write some more game here for us to hunt, something easily brought down with plenty of meat on it and a good flavour. Fenolio! She'd actually pulled the blanket off him. This was incredible. Rosenquartz put his head out of the pocket where he had taken to sleeping, and rubbed his eyes.
"Good morning, Rosenquartz. Get some paper out and sharpen the pens."
That tone of voice, just like a hospital nurse. Fenolio sat up with a groan. He really was too old to be sleeping on the floor of a damp cave.
"That's my glass man, and he does what I tell him to do," he grunted.
But before he knew it, Rosenquartz was scurrying past him with a syrupy sweet smile on his pale pink lips. What by all the ink devils was he playing at? The glass-headed traitor. How eagerly he did as she told him, whereas if he, Fenolio, asked Rosenquartz for something, it didn't arrive half so quickly.
Wonderful,
whispered Signora Loredan.
Thank you, Rosenquartz.
Eleanor. It's not the name I'd have given her, thought Fenolio, as he forced his feet into his boots, shivering. Something more warlike would fit her much better. Penthesilea, or Boadicea, or some such Amazon. Heavens, it was cold in this cave, too. Can't you change the weather somehow, Fenolio? Could he? As he blew on his cold hands, his uninvited visitor held out a steaming mug to him.
Here you are. Doesn't taste particularly good, but it's hot. Coffee made from tree bark. You know, Rosenquartz really is a delightful glass man, she whispered to him in a confidential tone. Jasper is very nice too, but so shy. And then there's that pink hair.
Flattered, Rosenquartz ran his fingers over it. Glass men's ears were certainly as keen as any owl's, which was why, even with their fragile limbs, they made such good spies. Fenolio could cheerfully have stuffed the vain little creature into his empty wineskin. He took a sip of the hot brew. It really did taste nasty. Got to his feet and dipped his face in the basin of water that Minerva always left ready for him in the evening. Did he just imagine it, or was there a thin layer of ice on the surface?
You really don't understand the first thing about writing, Loredan, he growled.
That was it, Loredan. That's what he'd call her in future. It suited her much better than the flowery Eleanor.
For one thing, early in the morning is the worst possible time. The brain is like a wet sponge at that hour. And for another, real writing is a question of staring into space and waiting for the right ideas.
Well, you are certainly very good at staring into space.
Oh, what a sharp tongue she had.
Next, you'll be telling me that tipping brandy and mead down your throat encourages the flow of ideas, too.
Had Rosenquartz just nodded in agreement, he'd chase him out into the forest where his wild cousins would teach him to eat snails and beetles.
Well, then, Loredan, I'm sure you've known all along how this story ought to turn out. Let me guess. I suppose a frozen sparrow told you the ending yesterday when you were sitting outside the cave, gazing at my forest and my fairies, totally beguiled by them.
Damn it, another tear in his trousers. And Batista had hardly any yarn left for mending clothes.
Inkweaver.
Despina came around the wall that allowed him for a few precious moments to forget where he was.
Do you want any breakfast?
Dear, kind Minerva. She still looked after him as if they were back in her house in Umbra. Fenolio sighed. The good old days.
No, thank you, Despina,
he replied, looking sideways at his other visitor.
Tell your mother that unfortunately someone ruined my appetite first thing today.
Despina and Eleanor exchanged a glance that could only be called conspiratorial. Good heavens, were even Minerva's children on Loredan's side now?
Risa has been gone for 2 days, not to mention Snapper. But what was the good of leaving you the book if you're just going to sleep the day away or drink bad wine with Batista? Dear God, how delightful this world had been when he hadn't had that voice ringing in his ears the whole time. You owe it to Mortimer to give him a few words to help him. Who else is going to do it? The Black Prince is too weak, and Mortimer's poor daughter is just waiting for you to give her something to read aloud at long last. But oh, no, no, it's too cold, the wine is bad, the children make too much noise. How is anyone supposed to write? You don't run out of words when it comes to complaining.
There. Rosenquartz was nodding again. I'll mix soup in his sand, thought Fenoglio, so much soup that he writhes with stomach cramps like the Black Prince, and I won't write a single word to cure him.
Fenoglio, are you listening to me?
She was looking at him as reproachfully as a teacher, asking where his homework was. The book. Yes, Risa had left it here for him. So what use was that supposed to be? It just reminded him how easy he had once found storytelling, before he put every word down on paper, knowing that it could become reality.
It can't be all that difficult. Mortimer has done almost all the work for you in advance. He's going to pretend to the Adderhead that he can heal the book. Then Violante will distract her father's attention, and Mortimer will write the three words in it. Maybe afterward there'll be a duel with the Piper. That kind of thing always reads well. I suppose the Fire Dancer will put on a show, too. Although, personally, I still don't like him. And yes, you could have Risa playing a part as well. She could keep that horrible snapper occupied. I don't know just how, but I'm sure you'll think of something.
Be quiet, thundered Fenoglio, in such a loud voice that Rosenquartz, terrified, took refuge behind the inkwell. What outrageous nonsense. That's just typical. Readers and their ideas. Yes, Mortimer's plan sounds really good. Plain and simple, but good. He overcomes the Adderhead, with Violante's help, writes the three words, Adderhead dead, Blue Jay saved, Violante ruler of Umbra. Oh, yes, it sounds wonderful. I tried writing it like that last night. It doesn't work. Dead words. This story doesn't like taking an easy path. It has other ideas. I can smell that in the air. But what are they? I brought the Piper into it. I gave Dustfinger his fair share of the action. But then, something or other was missing. Someone or other was missing. Someone who's going to thwart Mortimer's fine plan with a vengeance. Snapper? No, he's too stupid. But who? Sootbird? She was looking at him so anxiously. Well, well, at last she understood. But the next moment she was as defiant as ever. It was a wonder she didn't stamp her foot like a child. She was a child, disguised as a rather stout, middle-aged woman.
But that's all nonsense. You're the author, you, and no one else.
Oh, yes? So why is Cosimo dead, then? Did I write about Mortimer binding the book in a way that would leave the Adderhead rotting alive? No. Was it my idea to make Snapper jealous of him and her ugliness suddenly want to kill her father? Definitely not. I just planted this story, but it's growing the way it wants to, and everyone expects me to know in advance what kind of flowers it will have.
Good God, that incredulous look. As if he'd been talking about Santa Claus. But finally she thrust out her chin. It was quite an imposing chin, and that never boded well.
Excuses, nothing but excuses. You can't think of anything, and Risa's on the way to that castle. Suppose the Adderhead gets there long before she does. Suppose he doesn't trust his daughter, and Mortimer is dead before...
And suppose Mortola is back, as Risa says... Fenoglio brusquely interrupted her. Suppose Snapper kills Mortimer because he's jealous of the Blue Jay. Suppose Violante hands Mortimer over to her father after all because she can't bear to be rejected by yet another man. What about the Piper? What about Violante's spoiled son? What about all that?
His voice grew so loud that Rosenquartz hid under his blanket.
Stop shouting!
Suddenly, Signora Loredan sounded unusually subdued.
Poor Rosenquartz's head will be splitting.
No, it won't, because his head is as empty as a sucked-out snail's shell. Mine, on the other hand, has to think about difficult problems, matters of life and death. But it's my glass man that gets your sympathy, and you drag me out of bed after I've been lying awake half the night, straining my ears, trying to get this story to tell me where it wants to go.
She fell silent. She actually fell silent. She bit her surprisingly feminine lower lip, and plucked a few burrs off the dress that Minerva had given her, lost in thought.